They're just so dear, I always want to bring them up to the pulpit with me, but got a feeling that maybe that might be a little bit upsetting to you. Well, it was pretty upsetting to the congregation. It was really one of my first sermons I'd ever preached. I'm sure my wife, Pat, remembers this very, very well, because our dear, precious little daughter, Patty, was sitting with her mom, where we assumed she would stay quite peaceably and comfortably all through the worship service. She's a good PK, right? No problem with that. Well, she did love her daddy, and her daddy loved her. So as I began to preach, she slipped out of her place and came up and stood by me and just held my hand while I preached. Wow, what a time that was. what a message I think that communicated to the congregation. I didn't know how long that would last, but I was just pleasantly surprised, even amazed, that it lasted for a good while. Thanks be to the Lord. We continue with Nehemiah today, and we go into the second chapter. And if you want to look ahead, I think I previewed a little bit last time. Lord willing, next Sunday, we are going to be looking at God's strategy for our wall, which certainly is reflected in our vision and mission statements that you have in your hands today. But God's strategy for our wall, what does he have for Eagle Heights? How are we to build our testimony in this place and in this world? How are we to get ahead in his service? What does he want from us as we build a wall for his glory here? So it'll be God's strategy for our wall. And then in chapter 4, the week after that, we're going to be looking at how you live under great pressure. I entitled that one, Living in a Pressure Cooker. Today we look at chapter 2 in Nehemiah. And we're looking specifically today at how we face the challenges of our lives. And I would ask you to be mindful of the challenges you face personally, as well as of the challenges that you see our church facing, to have a strong testimony and witness here in this community and across this world. What are the challenges you're facing? Is it a matter of your own personal devotional life? Is it a matter of your relationship with God? Is it a matter of your relationship with your spouse or your children or your parents? Is it an issue of getting along in the world? Is it an issue at work? What is the issue? What is the challenge? What are you facing? We read here of the challenge that God gave to his servant Nehemiah around 445 BC. In the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was before him, I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had not been sad in his presence. And the king said to me, "Why is your face sad, seeing you are not sick? This is nothing but sadness of heart." And I was very much afraid. I said to the king, "Let the king live forever. Why should not my face be sad when the city, the place of my father's graves, lies in ruins, and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" Then the king said to me, "What are you requesting?" So I prayed to the God of heaven. And I said to the king, "If it pleases the king, if your servant has found favor in your sight, that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's graves, that I may rebuild it." And the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, "How long will you be gone? And when will you return?" So it pleased the king to send me when I had given him a time. And I said to the king, "If it pleases the king, let letters be given me to the governors of the province beyond the river, that they may let me pass through until I come to Judah, and a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress of the temple, and for the wall of the city, and for the house that I will occupy." And the king granted me what I asked, for the good hand of my God was upon me. Then I came to the governors of the province beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now the king had sent with me officers of the army and horsemen. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant heard this, it displeased them greatly that someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel. So I went to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Then I arose in the night, I and a few men with me, and I told no one what my God had put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. There was no animal with me but the one on which I rode. I went out by night by the valley gate to the dragon spring and to the dung gate. And I inspected the walls of Jerusalem that were broken down and its gates that had been destroyed by fire. Then I went on to the fountain gate into the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal that was under me to pass. Then I went up in the night by the valley and inspected the wall. And I turned back and entered by the valley gate and so returned. And the officials did not know where I'd gone or what I was doing. And I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, and the rest who were to do the work. Then I said to them, "You see the trouble we're in, how Jerusalem lies in ruins with its gates burned. Come, let us rebuild the wall of Jerusalem, that we may no longer suffer derision." And I told them of the hand of my God that had been upon me for good, and also of the words that the king had spoken to me. And they said, "Let us arise and build." So they strengthened their hands for the good work. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they jeered at us and despised us and said, "What is this thing you're doing? Are you rebelling against the king?" Then I replied to them, "The God of heaven will make us prosper, and we, his servants, will arise and build. But you have no portion or right or claim in Jerusalem." God be praised for his glorious and inerrant word. What a story. You remember, don't you, last week, if you were here, how we saw that how Nehemiah received news from his homeland. That now for more than half a century the city had lain as it had been when Nebuchadnezzar had utterly destroyed it. No one had done anything about building the walls or restoring the gates. It was one huge pile of debris and junk. And Nehemiah senses right away after his brother Hanani and the other men reported that to him. He senses right away that God is calling him to have a part in this. And he knows immediately that it will be a task beyond him humanly. In fact, I think he saw and believed it would be beyond any human being. It was an incredibly large task. Amazingly so. And you remember how he felt the burden of that call of God in his spirit. He said, I sat down and I wept for days. I mourned and I fasted and I prayed. And he kept on doing that, he tells us. And then he had the vision shaped in his mind, as we've had a vision shaped in our minds. A vision to proceed and do what God was calling him to do. Against all adversity, against all that appeared to him incredibly beyond humanity, much less beyond him, Nehemiah. The call to leave a very comfortable and highly esteemed place of service in the Persian court, by the way. To go to this desolate place of ruins and to this huge challenge of rebuilding the walls and restoring the gates. Keep in mind now that Nehemiah is third wave. As I mentioned, this is about the year 445 BC. 13 years before, Ezra had come with a number of the exiles back to Jerusalem. And Ezra's job was to get the priests trained to lead worship and minister to the flock. Before him, in about 526 BC, had come Prince Zerubbabel with a fairly large contingent of Israelites back to Jerusalem. And his job was to rebuild the temple, remember? So you see in sequence what God wanted. 526 thereabouts, Zerubbabel comes to rebuild the temple. 458 or thereabouts, Ezra comes. He's a scribe, a priest. He's going to train the priests for ministry in that temple. And 13 years later, Nehemiah comes because the walls of that city have to be restored. They are more than physical protection, though they're that. They are the emblems of God's protection of his people. And they need to be rebuilt. The debris has to be carted off, and the walls have to be rebuilt. The gates have to be restored, and Lord willing, we'll see that as we come to the week before Easter on Palm Sunday. We're going to see the Lord's anointed. We're going to see the King of Glory. They were emblematic of the opening of the hearts of the people for the King of Glory to come in. That's what the gates represented. So here's a whole panoply of what God wants done in Jerusalem, and none of it is easy. Not for Zerubbabel, not for Ezra, and now not for Nehemiah. But what a man of prayer. You see, when he stands before the king, he's afraid for his life. Because I believe this might have been a festival time. I don't know that for sure. But clearly, the queen was with the king, and they were sitting, and wine was being served. Probably nothing unusual there, but it appears to be a time of joy. In addition to that, it was not a good thing for you to be sad in the presence of the king. Might lose your head for that. Well, Nehemiah is really upset. I love the way he responds when the king accosts him. He said, I know you're not sick. What's wrong? I sense your heart is very sad. I love the way he responds. Nehemiah says, may the king live forever. That's great. With all respect, may the king live forever. But he levels. He says, why should I not be sad when my hometown is a stack of debris? Why should I not be sad? I know something must be done about it. The king said, what do you want? I know my heart. I was sharing with the Sunday school class on prayer. I know that what I'd have done. I'd have said, oh, well, I want a fleet of 17 or 18 Mercedes trucks. And I love that coupe for myself, please. I'd have just burst out with all the stuff that I wanted. But he didn't do that. Did you notice? There's a pause here. When the king asks, what do you want? He says, so I prayed to the Lord. I wonder if we live that way. I wonder if I live that way. And God did give him instructions. So then he says to the king, well, I will need some timber to have large beams to rebuild the citadel, the fortress adjacent to the temple. And certainly for my own house, I'll need safe transport. And I'll need some cavalry, if you don't mind. So he gives him his practical shopping list. He gives him what he needs for his job, not what he needs for his own feathering of his nest. Not something for his own comfort. He says, this is what I need for ministry. Wouldn't it be great if Eagle Heights always had that perspective, that we ask the Lord only and specifically for those things that would empower our ministry in the world? For instance, when we ask the Lord for land and a building, it wouldn't be for our comfort, I hope. It would be for his glory and for the better equipping of his people 24/7, wouldn't it? I think it has to be. He asks what is necessary for his ministry. And because the hand of his God was upon him, he testifies, and later he testifies that to the folks that are going to work with him on the walls, because the good hand of his Lord was upon him, the king gave him everything he asked for. Incidentally, I've often wondered about this business. The king says, how long are you going to be gone? Nehemiah is a good and faithful servant. Not irreplaceable, but tough to replace. So the king says, how long are you going to be gone? Well, I know just about how long he was gone. Chapter 5 will tell us. I think around 12 years. And I wonder if Nehemiah told the king that. He certainly told him something, because the text says that he gave him a time. And perhaps even then Nehemiah knew it was going to take more than 10 years. I know not, because I'm not told here. But the king is satisfied. He sends Nehemiah on his way. And he comes to Jerusalem, but not without a symbol of what's ahead. Because there beside the road are some formidable adversaries who are stating their case already. Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant. Now, you may get the wrong idea about Tobiah. He was not a flunky to Sanballat. He was a servant. I think he was probably the governor of Ammon, which was east of Judah. I think he was an official there, not a flunky. But he was a servant in the sense that he was not the first man. And he must have followed the lead of Sanballat the Horonite. By the way, these names are really, really fascinating. Sanballat, the name Sanballat actually is a Babylonian name, and it means God will actually give you leadership and how to live. But that God was a moon god, Sin. I guess that's a play on words, S-I-N. But his is a Babylonian name, and that means that God, Sin, the moon god, would give leadership personally in the life. But I really think Tobiah's name is even more interesting, because the name Tobiah means the Lord is good. Maybe he had no idea that his very name meant that the Lord is good to this person you are deriding, this person you are criticizing, this person you will try to kill after you offer him some compromises. The Lord is good. Indeed he is, and I find this absolutely fascinating. Sanballat and Tobiah, later Geshem the Arab, as you heard near the end of the chapter, joins in that chorus. But Nehemiah is forewarned. The job won't be easy, because you're going to have great difficulty with these people, because they will despise you because you are coming to help the local Jewish population. That's the last thing they want. they're very happy with the thing that's there. And even as the local Jewish population that had done nothing, remember, they would not be particularly happy with Nehemiah, because I found this out from my earliest days in the classroom at school, that there's nothing that mediocrity hates more than excellence. There's nothing that laziness despises more than alertness and hard work. And so that's always the case. But these guys want the worst for the Jews. And they despise Nehemiah because they sense this guy, and they know what's happening. Zerubbabel has built the temple already. And Ezra has been on the job now for 12 or 13 years training the priests. They're mindful something's going on here. So they see this as their opportunity to stop the rebuilding of the walls, to make it easier for commando raids and the rest of that. Don't you see? So there's a preparation by the Lord of Nehemiah for the opposition that lies ahead of him. But he proceeds, and there are three things here I want to talk about quickly, and then we'll go to the Lord's table. I want to talk first about, well, these are really principles of how you and I face our challenges. And I wonder how well we do this. First of all, there's a principle of investigation. And secondly, there's this marvelous principle of our church, which is called cooperation, or working together. And finally, there's a manifestation on Nehemiah's part and those who build with him of great determination. So simple, isn't it? Investigation, cooperation, and determination. Let's see how it worked out. How would we have gone about this? Thought about this when Pat and I were led of the Lord to go to Northern California to plant the first PCA church in that region. As I was praying about that for a long time and wondering how to do that, I was tempted to take the real sensational route and call a press conference of the San Francisco Chronicle and the Contra Costa Times and all of that stuff. Then I remembered Nehemiah. He was 3 days before he did anything ostensible. He just sort of slipped into town. He was there 3 days. He didn't call a press conference with the Jerusalem Post. He didn't ask to be interviewed by the local reporters. He didn't even say to Zerubbabel's guys and Ezra's guys, let's get together and have a joint presentation and communicate to the whole community what we're doing. No evidence in the text of that. He comes in very quietly, and through a nocturnal, look at this, through a nocturnal hard hat tour, checks it out. Yeah, through a nightly hard hat tour, he has got to one place in the debris was so high and awful that he had to get off his horse and go on foot. But he comes to check it out. It's a time of investigation. Did you notice here that twice the word inspected is used? That's in verses 13 and 15. The word inspected, the walls. I was really impressed with the Hebrew. I'm not a Hebrew scholar, but I know a bit about it. And I tried to figure out, as I studied that Hebrew word, what would be the closest application in our 21st century life. Let me tell you what it would be. The word inspected would apply to... Have you ever cut open your head or your knee or somewhere on your body and had to go to the ER? I bet most of you have. I know I'm doing what I shouldn't be doing. I split my head a couple of years back and had to go to the emergency room and have that thing. They didn't suture it. They put staples in there. Amazing. But you know, as they were doing that, the doctors had a very bright light. And of course they had to do that because the wound has to be cleansed, doesn't it? You can't leave things in there that might lead to infection, can you? So they brought down this piercingly bright light as they cleaned the wound and prepared for stapling. Boy, that's a wretched term. Well, that's what they were doing. But I was looking at that light, and that's exactly what the word inspect here means. It's a penetrating, realistic analysis. So Nehemiah's not playing games. He sees how tough this job is. He saw these huge mounds of debris that had lain there since the city was absolutely ravished and ravaged by Nebuchadnezzar 70 years before. He saw that. He was realistic about that. But I'm impressed as he takes his tour and inspects those walls under the very hard light of reality. He's avoided the sensational, he's avoided the spectacular, and now he looks at the realistic condition the city is in. And doesn't he say that in a few moments or a few hours to those that are going to do the work? He said, you see the mess we're in. You see the trouble we've got here. Realistic, but not depressed. Please track me with me on this. Realistic, but not switched off. How often have we seen the sin in our own lives as we have today and been paralyzed by it? How often have we seen the hugeness of our spiritual challenges at home or out in the community, at work, wherever, and absolutely switched off? Because we see how huge this challenge is. We look at it realistically, but we don't do what Nehemiah did. We don't say, well, nothing's too tough for God. Yes, this is tough. This is big. This is hard. But God has brought me here. God has put us here. And God is going to do something here. So the first principle is, check it out realistically, but guard yourself against being cast down. Guard yourself against depression. Guard yourself against discouragement. Keep on praying. Lord, may I trust you through all of this. May I see your greatness in this. May I not be overcome by this. How often are we just overcome by our sin, overcome by our circumstances, overcome by the hardness of life in a moment and longer than that? How often? No. Realistic, but not discouraged, not depressed. Then there's secondly, cooperation, verses 17 and 18. And you know how I feel about this. I think the greatest thing here is a transition of pronouns from I and me to us and we. This is a dead giveaway to what God is doing here and what God has for us here. In cooperation as members of the body of Christ together in the church, we got to watch our pronouns. Because our pronouns mustn't always be I and me. Our pronouns ought to be us and we. And that's what happens here. As he gathers the folks who will do the work, he says to them, look at it realistically. You see the ruins. You see the mess. You see these piles of debris, and you know there are not any walls left. We've got to build these walls that we may no longer suffer derision. Well, we see in just a moment that Sanballat, Tobiah, joined by Geshem, now will deride them. They will engage in derision, and they will jeer, and they will despise them, and they'll say, what are you doing? Are you rebelling against the king? Later on, they say, this miserable wall you're building, if a fox jumped up there, it would tear it down. Great people, huh, to have around you. Real encouragement, right? Piling on, like you carried the ball and you're already down, and six guys pile on you. So that's what it is. That's what it was. Nehemiah says, be realistic about it. We've got a lot of shame and disgrace to remove through hard work and diligent service of our living Lord. But he gives a testimony of grace here. He says again, I told them of the hand of my God that had been upon me for good. Also the words of the king. He gave them testimony about how God changed the mind of a king. And Nehemiah is saying here, read between the lines. Nehemiah is saying, look, If the Lord can do this with the king to let me come here and be with you to build the walls and put back the gates, if God can do that, consider his greatness. Consider his greatness. So there's a sense of coming together under God's hand to do this. And that leads us into the third principle, which is after investigation and cooperation, determination. You'll see this all through the book of Nehemiah. Probably have studied it before. I hope you have. Marvelous story of perseverance. And of a patient service, and of never, ever giving up. Boy, at the halfway house, they almost did. Boy, how much like me that is. You're halfway there, and that's a tough testing point, isn't it? And they almost caved. But because of God's use of this man, they didn't cave. He, and because of him, they became determined to see it through. And what is the way you deal with the pressure of the world, the derision, the criticism, the spite and the hatred of the world? How do you deal with that? Well, Nehemiah just mans that. He just faces up to it. He says, listen, we're here to do God's work through God's power in God's time because we're God's people. That's a great motto. God's work through God's power in God's time by God's people. He says to this group of people, he says, guys, you're not going to succeed. We are. Not because we're so great, but because God is with us. We're doing His work in His way and His time because we're His people. And we're using His tools. And this will be successful. But He said, as for you, I'm sorry to tell you, you don't have any portion here. You've missed your opportunity. It's gone. No right, no portion, no claim anymore in Jerusalem. So Nehemiah and these folks who did the building, as we'll see next week, were built for battle. One of the very tough portions of the New Testament is John 15, especially that section from, I think it's verse 18 on through verse 27. In John 15, Jesus, do you remember this? Jesus said to His disciples, because the world has hated me, it's going to hate you. Because the world despises me, it's going to despise you. Because the world has sought to kill me, the world will seek to kill you. He said, guys, you have to face up to this. It's going to be a tough time because the world has persecuted me, the world will persecute you. But He put it this way, did Jesus, in verse 21 of John 15. But all these things they will do to you on account of my name. On account of my name. It's for me, so don't take it personally. It's for me. I'm the reason for this. I can't tell you how this has comforted me in very tough places of my life. When I did take it personally, and people were just coming savagely at me, and then the Holy Spirit taught me in Scripture, no. You're not that important, Cordy. Where'd you get the idea you're that important? It isn't that they despise you because you're doing such good work. No. You're not that important. It's because of your Lord. And it's only because of your fidelity to Him that they're coming at you. What a great encouragement. Jesus said, these things will happen because of my name. Because of me, because of who I am in you. And because of your pursuit of my will in the world. And you see that Nehemiah, and we'll discover more about this later, Nehemiah and his fellow workers are absolutely built for battle, absolutely committed and determined to do what God has called them to do. Here's a tagline. I hope I can think to mention it later. Here's a tagline. We find out in chapters 5 and 6 that the wall got rebuilt. Listen to this. The wall got rebuilt and the gates got put back in 52 days. This gives me a great opportunity with young people especially who are always impressed, as I have been, with the huge earth-moving equipment and all these marvelous computerized pieces of equipment we have today. So the kids, I ask the kids, how long do you think it would take to do the job at Jerusalem? They say, oh, well, no time at all. No time at all because of all the technology, all of these great machines that we have. And I say to them, well, it got done in 52 days, and today you wouldn't even have negotiated the union contracts. In 52 days, you'd probably have four conferences with the architect, and you're still deep in that and don't understand what he's saying. No, we wouldn't do it in 52 days. This was God's work. It was being done in God's way, by God's people, in God's timetable. And boy, was God ever determined to see it done. The rebuilding of the temple, the restoration of the priesthood, and now the rebuilding of the walls and the restoration of the gates. Doesn't that encourage you? That God in His great love and mercy took an honestly broken sinner named Nehemiah and made him a faithful and fruitful servant, a valiant warrior for truth. May that same severe love shake you and me today out of whatever comfort zone we've got. May we not go to the comfort zones. May it bring us to the utter joy of raising a wall of testimony to the grace and glory of our God. Thanks be to God.